This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This week, the federal terrorism trial of Tariq Mahana of Sudbury concluded.
The verdict, guilty on all charges.
The job of law enforcement agencies and prosecutors is to bring terrorists to justice.
Critics of the verdict call it a troubling attack on basic rights.
It is a sad day for civil rights. It's a sad day for the First Amendment.
Meanwhile, the race for the GOP presidential nomination was in high gear this week. Mitt Romney took his bus tour to New Hampshire and declined Newt Gingrich's challenge to a one-on-one debate.
If he and I both remain as the leading contenders, which may well be the case or may not, that will probably occur at some point down the road.
But not today. And today, Congress extended the payroll tax, but it wasn't easy.
It seems that everything we've done this last year has been a knockdown, drag-out fight.
A fight that drew Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown, who parted company with many of his fellow Republicans.
So those were some of the main stories this week. And joining us now to talk about them is our Week in Review team, Joan Vinaki, columnist for the Boston Globe. Hi, Joan. Great to have you in.
Nice to be here.
And Peter Canellos, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe. Hey, Peter.
Hey.
sounding exuberant there.
Exuberant, yes. It's Christmas coming. Yeah.
That's right. We have eggnog and bourbon at the other end of this program, so we're battening down the hatches here. So let's start with the verdict in the Tariq Mahana trial. Mahana charged with conspiring to support al-Qaeda, plotting to kill American soldiers in Iraq, also accused of seeking terrorism training in Yemen, which he didn't manage to do. He translated al-Qaeda texts and posted them on the internet. Were you surprised by this verdict? Guilty on all counts? Joan, let me start with you.
Well, I don't know if I was surprised, but yeah, I agree with the critics who say it's a little bit troubling. I mean, they say Congress has broadened the statutes that make it a crime to give material support to terrorist groups. And in this case, material support, I mean, that really kind of stretched the meaning. And I think, you know, politically, it's interesting. Liberals complained and, you know, jumped up and down when things like this happened on George Bush's watch. But there isn't all that much complaining going on under the Obama administration.
Interesting. Peter Canellos, what's your take on this case?
Well, one thing that I think is interesting is that it wasn't played up nationally as a big deal, which is a signal that the Justice Department doesn't really feel that Mahana was like a big threat to anything. So in that context, I think we have to be a little bit concerned that maybe, you know, the way the laws are written and the way the jury interpreted them led to a more sweeping verdict than was justified in this case.
Mm. Well, Mahana never actually hurt anyone, as we mentioned, but the government said it acted before that could happen. Here's U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz.
Once the government learned that Mr. Mahana's of his intentions towards America, especially American soldiers, and his increasing radicalization, to have done nothing would have been inexcusable.
Joan, I was struck by a couple of words in that statement, the word intentions and sort of the concept of radicalization as being a basis for a case like this.
Right. He was trying to engage in something, seems to be the premise of this prosecution. And the judge's instruction said they had to work in coordination with or at the direction of a terrorist group. And at least from what I read in the Boston Globe, I didn't actually see that. I guess the jurors saw something different.
Peter, does this set a new precedent for the prosecution of terrorism suspects going forward?
Well, it comes at a very interesting time because, as you know, the Defense Authorization Act gives the president the power to move many, many more terrorism suspects into the military system, where presumably they'll be dealt with more harshly than in the civilian system. This actually suggests that in a federal court, a regular federal court, before a regular jury, people are going to get harsh treatment indeed. It's conceivable that Mahana would have had a better shot in a military tribunal.
Well, let's move on to presidential campaign politics. There are less than 2 weeks to go before the Iowa caucuses, followed by the New Hampshire primary. Mitt Romney spent much of this week campaigning across the Granite State the old school way in a bus, while other candidates focus more on Iowa. Peter, why do you think Mitt Romney was spending so much time in New Hampshire, a state that he apparently has sewed up, and rather than in Iowa?
Well, I don't think he's sewn it up, and I think that he understands the expectations game here. He is not expected to win Iowa. If he wins Iowa, he's sort of exceeded everybody's expectations for him, and it looks great. He is expected to win New Hampshire, so if he doesn't win New Hampshire, it'll be played as a big defeat, a big questioning of his viability as a national candidate. So he sort of knows New Hampshire is the one that he has to nail down, and that's why he's up there.
Yeah, and of course, Joan, New Hampshire can play tricks on people. Voters are not always predictable. And a win really has to be a win to be a win. In other words, if he just sort of ekes out a victory, it could be cast as a loss. Right?
Right. The history of New Hampshire is the media decides what a win is, mm-hmm. the meaning of a win. And you know, the example that's always used with Romney is sort of the Paul Tsongas, Bill Clinton scenario. Where you've got New Hampshire is basically Romney's home state. He's got to win big, as Peter said. Media will decide how big really is big. If somebody sneaks in close enough on second, you know, he's in trouble. So it's the proverbial firewall.
Meanwhile, a big flap this week over political ads. The pro-Romney super PAC Restore Our Future launched an attack ad against Newt Gingrich. The Washington Post, by the way, gave it 4 Pinocchios for its alleged distortions. Gingrich demanded the ad be taken down. For his part, Romney has tried to distance himself from the super PAC while also criticizing the role super PACs were playing in the race. Here he is.
Campaign finance law has made a mockery of our political campaign season. We really ought to let campaigns raise the money they need and just get rid of these super PACs.
But when Gingrich said Romney should tell Restore Our Future to stop running the attack ads, Romney had this to say.
If you can't handle the heat in this little kitchen, the heat that's going to come from Obama's Hell's Kitchen is going to be a heck of a lot hotter. We have to show that we, as a Republican party and as a candidate, that we can stand up to the barrage that's going to come from the Obama world.
Peter Canellos, is Romney playing it both ways here?
A little bit, but did he say Obama's health kitchen in there or something? That's a little odd. I think it was Hell's Kitchen. Yeah,
oh, Hell's
Kitchen.
It's actually strong language from Mitt Romney.
Yeah, quite interesting. Yes, I think he is trying to play it a little bit both ways. I think that he may be right about the campaign finance laws, and we have this situation where these super PACs exist, and supposedly they're not coordinated with the candidates, and we all kind of suspect that they are, but then the candidates have a chance to distance themselves from all the bad stuff that the super PACs are doing by saying legally they can't weigh in. It's a bad situation that does need to be corrected, and I think Romney is right about that. I think that Romney has already put forward some misleading ads under his own campaign name. And, you know, he runs a risk if he and his supporters are perceived as playing sort of dirty pool with some of these other candidates. So I would have encouraged him to step forward against negative campaigning.
Joan Vinocchi, what's your take on this super PAC ad controversy?
Well, at the risk of sounding incredibly cynical right before Christmas, I mean, to me, it's classic Mitt Romney. Have you ever heard someone want to have it both ways more than with Romney? He's against super PACs, but he's not really, calling this one out. I mean, he thinks it's a terrible thing. Meanwhile, he's benefiting from the negative advertising. I don't know. It's kind of more the same from Romney.
Yesterday, we had James Pindle from WMUR in Manchester on this show. And his take was the race in New Hampshire is basically coming down to 2 candidates. It's not Gingrich and Romney. It's Romney and Ron Paul. What do you think, Joan? Are we seeing a shift in the top positions of this race?
Well, James Pindle is in New Hampshire. I'm not. He may be right. I'm looking to see what John Huntsman does. I think it'd be interesting how he places. I've always thought of him as the adult on the stage. He is conservative. He's really, you know, put a lot of time and effort into New Hampshire. I guess Ron Paul will watch him, but Huntsman's interesting to watch as well.
Peter Canellos, what's your take on sort of as we're less than, just a little more than 2 weeks away from the New Hampshire primary?
My take is the same as Jones, and that is that if somebody's going to break out and really do a lot better than the polls are suggesting right now, it's Huntsman because of support from independents or potentially Democrats will register as independent and take a Republican ballot for this race. I think a lot of that depends, though, on there being a strong conservative alternative to Romney, in which case Romney kind of gets boxed in between Huntsman's supporters on the left and a stronger conservative candidate on the right. Whether that is Gingrich or whether it's Ron Paul, I don't know. But if somebody's going to beat Romney in New Hampshire, I'd bet it would be Huntsman.
Interesting. Well, Mitt Romney avoided commenting on a major story this week, the bitter fight in Congress over extending the payroll tax cut, which finally passed today. Newt Gingrich, however, waded into the fray, saying the Democratic-controlled Senate should have extended the cuts for a year instead of just 2 months, which he said will only bring the issue back in late February. Here he is.
So they can pass it for 2 months to have another crisis. I mean, this is about as stupid a way to run a country. I mean, it's embarrassing. This is worthy of the Italian Parliament.
Worthy of the Italian Parliament. Peter Canellis, Congress has public approval levels that have dropped through the floor. Does Gingrich win points with voters by criticizing this process like this?
He might, but I think it's sort of a fundamentally unserious kind of cynical response from Gingrich. I mean, he knows how Congress works better than anybody does, and he knows that the Democrats, who are leaders in the Senate, had put forward a plan to pay for a year-long payroll tax cut with a surcharge on million-dollar tax filers. That was blocked by a Republican filibuster. There was no way they were going to get that through, and so they abandoned it due to Republican opposition. The only compromise that came about was the two-month delay. He may be right in some larger sense that people are processing this as a sign of congressional dysfunction, and it certainly is. But to sort of blithely suggest that, you know, whatever, the Democrats in the Senate are trying to pull a fast one here is disingenuous.
And apparently he doesn't care about the Italian vote, Joan.
I know. That was actually a funny line. I laughed. Well, I guess I agree with Peter. We're like in the Mutual Admiration Society here. I think Gingrich is right. It's cynical. There was no way they were going to extend it for a year. But on the public relations front, the Republicans in Congress lost this one. For once, it was a Christmas, an early Christmas present for President Obama, and sort of the first little victory that gives them a spring in the step, you know, going into the new year, I think. They just really were outmaneuvered.
Well, let's talk about Senator Scott Brown in this context. He did join the payroll tax debate earlier this week. He came out against House Speaker Boehner and many of his fellow Republicans in the House who initially blocked the two-month extension. Brown called the maneuver irresponsible and wrong. Joan, what do you make of Brown's criticism of his Republican colleagues in the other chamber?
He feels Elizabeth Warren's breath on his neck.
Yeah.
That's what I think. He did the right thing, and I suppose it doesn't matter what the motivation was. I think he wins points for it. I mean, I heard actually, I think on MSNBC, Doris Kearns Goodwin praising Scott Brown and saying that we need more Scott Browns in Congress and the Senate. So I think it was a win for Brown.
Here's Scott Brown talking about the problem in, what else, his holiday video message. Here it is.
You know, in Washington, we're dealing with some tough challenges, and I'll continue to work with people of goodwill on both sides of the aisle to move our country forward, you know, because we're Americans first, and we owe that to you and your families.
So that's Senator Scott Brown. Peter Canellis says, as Brown moves closer to a reelection challenge, Joan mentioned he can feel Elizabeth Warren's breath on his back. Do you think we'll see him distancing himself more frequently from Washington Republicans?
A little bit more, but I think it's been undernoted how much Brown has sort of cleaned up his act in the last 6 months. The two charges against him are that he came across as being sort of indecisive and sort of waited until the last minute to make up his mind on things, and that he wasn't enough of a leader in terms of actually proposing legislation. Since then, he's taken on the fishing issue, which is huge in Gloucester and New Bedford and places like that, challenging the federal government very strongly on the fishing limits there. He's also proposed the bill to prevent Congress from making conflict of interest investments. He's also pushed a portion of a jobs bill. He's been more outspoken, as we just saw last week, early in the process, calling people out. This is an improved Scott Brown, whether the polls show it or not, and he's putting himself in a better position for next year.
Interesting. Well, it's going to be an interesting race no matter what, I think.
I think he's still a senator by press release, though. He doesn't really do much give and take with the press.
Not yet, anyway. We'll see if we can change that going forward. Well, let's move on to our last topic. We'll deal with this relatively briefly. Cantabrigians can fret no more. Harvard has been returned to the public, sort of. This week, Harvard announced it would reopen Harvard Yard to the public, but for limited hours. The yard was shut down, of course, for weeks because of the Occupy Harvard encampment. So, what do we make of this, Peter and Joan? This strange example of an Occupy demonstration walled off from the public for so many weeks within Harvard's cloistered walls of privilege. What do you, Joan?
It was a very strange hybrid, I think. What else to say? It was like the 1% protesting the 1%. And it, you know, it sort of made kind of a mockery, I think, of the protesting. That may be harsh. I mean, I understand what they were trying to do, but the way the university reacted to it made it look weird.
I guess what I didn't understand, Peter, is why the Occupy Harvard protesters didn't come outside the gates and protest outside.
I don't know. They're students, and they may have been trying to follow college rules, and that it may have been an issue. They didn't want to have too much of a confrontation with the college administration, which would have been a distraction to some degree. I think that the Occupy movement as a whole, whether it's at Harvard, whether it's at Dewey Square, whether it's in other cities, too much time has been spent for their purposes for the last month or two, all arguing about logistics of where and when and how they can be. It would behoove them to come up with a clearer focus, a new setting for their protests, a new platform for them to make their case, and hopefully they can continue and rebuild some of the energy that they had a few months ago.
Well, that's a big question, especially as we move toward the end of the year. What do you think, Joan? Is there going to be an Occupy something somewhere in 2012?
Well, they certainly have changed the conversation and in a way sort of defined a part of the debate, of the national debate. But, you know, as Peter said, I mean, it's up to them to decide what the next phase is. And right now, it's interesting. I mean, Democrats, you know, including Elizabeth Warren here in Massachusetts, are kind of keeping a wary distance. And I think until the Occupy movement redefines itself, I don't know how much support they're going to get from the political establishment.
Well, we have just enough time to move on to our hubbub, those stories that didn't quite make it above the fold this week. Peter Kanellis, what's your hubbub today?
Today I was in the Barnes & Noble at Prudential Center, which is the last mass market bookstore in Boston. There are some neighborhood independents. There's also a couple college bookstores, but it's the last old-fashioned large bookstore downtown, and it was hopping, which may say something good about hardcover books. It may also say something about the lack of competition, but you can only wonder what the future is going to bring. But I think that we would have a less literary, certainly a less high-minded society if we didn't have bookstores to go into and browse and chat and buy things.
I agree with that. Hear. Let's hear it for bookstores hanging in there for 2012. Joan Vanocki, your hubbub.
Well, I saw this inside the Boston Globe, the print version of the Globe, I will add. A Needham selectman named Richard Healy is quitting ahead of his term, partly for, I guess, personal reasons. He's got another job that he's going to, but also because this is the third time that he's come outside and found his tires slashed.
Oh, dear.
I don't know. They described it in the story as a fiscal conservative. I'm not sure if that had anything to do with the slashing of the tires, but it seems to me another example of incivility in politics. And in the Christmas spirit, I would say to Needham, it's time to stop and be nice.
Well, here's my hubbub, and speaking of incivility in politics, and Joan and Peter, I have to credit your paper because this came across this afternoon from Shira Schoenberg. So I'll just read the opening line because I think it's a good one. Newt Gingrich has promised to run a positive presidential campaign that apparently does not extend to comments about certain states. And you want to guess which state we're talking about?
Not the Bay State.
The Bay State. You got it. Quote, we're thinking of having a Massachusetts rally at some point in New Hampshire, sort of a please don't turn America into Massachusetts, the former House Speaker told around 125 people at the Radisson Hotel today. So, I don't know. Poor old Massachusetts taking it on the chin from Newt Gingrich.
I guess he won't be coming into the Globe, Peter, to speak to us.
Well, I want to wish you both a happy new year, happy holiday, Merry Christmas. Peter Kanellis, editorial page editor of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Joan Vanocki, columnist for the Boston Globe, thank you for coming in.
Thanks, and nice to be here.